Today on Against the Grain. Israel's military power has been on display following Hamas's attack and Israel's continuing assault on Gaza. Israel is one of the world's most important producers of military hardware and surveillance technology, honed in its occupation of Palestine and exported around the world to various brutal regimes. Anthony Lowenstein traces the history of Israel's military tech sector, while Sari Makdisi reflects on the Israeli state's cultivation of Western liberal support. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. As bombs rain down on Gaza, we look at the history of Israel's military technology industry and, later in the program, at how Israel has attempted to draw the support of progressives in the West. We'll first hear part of an interview with filmmaker and writer Anthony Lowenstein about his book, The Palestine Laboratory: How Israel Exports the Technology of Occupation Around the World. Please note that both conversations were recorded before the attack by Hamas on Israel and Israel's assault on Gaza. Israel's military and surveillance technology briefly came to prominence with Pegasus, the tool sold by the Israeli surveillance company NSO Group that was used to hack the phones of Amazon mogul Jeff Bezos and Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi, the latter before he was assassinated. When I spoke to Anthony Lowenstein, I asked how the occupation of Palestine helps drive Israel's technology and military sector.
Hugely, because Israel has been occupying Palestine, the West Bank, Gaza, East Jerusalem for over 50 years, 56 years and counting. And during those years, what Israel's done very cleverly from its perspective is devise tools and technologies to control Palestinians, a people that are, frankly doesn't really want to be there. And I'm talking about things like spyware, smart walls, biometric tools, facial recognition, drones, both deadly and surveillance. And because Palestinians are occupied, mostly have got little freedom of movement, especially in Gaza, they're essentially in the world's biggest open-air prison. They're kind of a captive population. And what Israel has then done, not just since 9/11, although it's certainly deepened since that awful day, is to promote and market those tools and technologies as so-called battle-tested. I mean, they say it openly, they being Israel as a government, but also Israeli companies. And they sell these tools and technologies to at least 130 countries around the world. And sometimes these countries are not even friends with Israel officially. I mean, Saudi Arabia is a good example, is not officially a friend of Israel. Indonesia, it doesn't even recognize Israel officially, and yet Israel is selling repressive technology to those nations. And I think what I find so disturbing about this is Israel, of course, is not the only arms dealer in the world. The US remains the world's biggest arms dealer by far. Germany, France also sell lots of horrible weapons around the world. But Israel has a captive population, the Palestinians. It is the 10th biggest arms exporter in the world. And Israel, of course, claims to be a thriving democracy in the Middle East, but actually it only can be a democracy for Jews because it represses millions of Palestinians who also want equal rights but don't get them.
When we talk about Israel and Israel's military sector, who exactly are we talking about? Are we talking about the Israeli state, private actors, or a combination of those?
We're talking about both. And one of the things that Israel has done, and this also happens in the US, is that companies are private, but really only on paper. And what I mean by that is, in the last decade, some listeners will remember hearing about Pegasus, which is the infamous spyware tool by NSO Group. That's the name of the company. Spyware, meaning that this can be installed on your cell phone and everything on your phone can be hacked. This could be emails, text messages, videos, audio, whatever, essentially. So-called encrypted messages, WhatsApp, Signal. And Although NSO Group is a private company, it essentially operates as an arm of the state. And what I mean by that is in the last 10 years, a bit more than that now, Netanyahu, as Prime Minister, who's been leader of Israel for most of that time, both his government and the Mossad have often gone to countries diplomatically and held out tools like Pegasus, almost as a carrot, to say, we either want to be friends with you, or we can help you if you, for example, help us at the UN by giving us certain votes, not voting in a certain way, we'll sell you this unbelievably powerful spyware. And it's worked. You have, and I talk about this extensively in the book, that wherever Netanyahu often has gone, Saudi Arabia, Rwanda, UAE, and others, within a number of months, this spyware has appeared on people's phones in those countries. So it's clearly closely tied together. And what's so disturbing, I guess, about this kind of spyware, obviously Pegasus is not the only company that is doing this. There are huge numbers of other Israeli companies doing this kind of work. And it's important for people to remember that this kind of technology is the product of an Israeli intelligence unit, particularly Unit 8200, that's the most infamous, although there are others, that actively encourages people, once they've left the army, to develop these kinds of tools. And so when they go into the private sector, they still have a very close tie to the Israeli intelligence services, to the Israeli state, and they almost operate as an arm of the state. This also happens in the US, right, where you have companies like Raytheon and others. And these companies essentially are an arm of the state. They operate very privately. They're, you know, they're often on the stock market, but they are essentially an arm of the state, and they do work on behalf of the state. And the nations in the end can't really survive without them. So decades and decades ago, Israel's defense industry was purely public. About 40 years ago, it moved increasingly into the private domain. But as I said, it's private only in name.
And we'll talk more about the contemporary appearance of the Israeli military sector. But I wonder if you could tell us about the early development and promotion of that part of Israel's economy and state, going back to the early days of the Israeli state's formation.
Look, right at the beginning in 1948, Israel was essentially often using weapons that they had stolen from the British. The British obviously controlled Palestine for a number of decades, and they weren't particularly designing hugely sophisticated weapons in 1948. It was mostly then fairly basic guns and other sort of tools. But very soon, in the 50s and particularly in the 60s, the Israeli government realized, so they thought, that the only way a state like that, a new state, could survive and thrive was to make friends, which on one hand makes a lot of sense. But the way that those friends were made was often through the development and export of weapons. It often started off with just guns, fairly basic. The Uzi gun, for example, some listeners may remember or have heard of, is an Israeli design weapon. But as time went on in the 60s and 70s and onwards, when the industry started to move into the private sector, and particularly this accelerated after 1967, the Six-Day War, where Israel gained control of the West Bank and Gaza, East Jerusalem, and began its occupation of Palestinian territory, those territories became a key testing ground for new weapons. And you see a very clear development in those years after that. In fact, to the point where a lot of countries are openly asking Israel for advice in so-called counterinsurgency. And Israel was openly happy to promote itself as an expert in so-called counterinsurgency against the Palestinian population. You know, one of the key relationships that I think defines so much of how Israel viewed itself in the past and arguably still does today is Israel and apartheid South Africa. That regime ended in 1994, but during the years of that regime, Israel and South Africa could not be closer. This wasn't just a defense relationship where weapons were being sold, but both nations viewed themselves kind of on in an existential battle for their existence. They framed themselves as against the evil forces of radicalism. Obviously, in South Africa's case, that was the black population. In Israel's case, it was the Palestinians. And both nations, and this has come out through declassified documents, many of which I put in the book, it really saw themselves as learning from each other how to control these so-called malevolent forces. So, for example, Israel would admire what South Africa was doing in its bantustans. Bantustans were areas where blacks were essentially corralled into said areas. They had no real independence whatsoever. But Israel admired that. And in fact, what Israel was trying to do in the West Bank and Gaza back then, when they had control over Gaza with settlements, was exactly that. And I think the reason all that is important is that it really goes to the heart of how Israel views itself as a nation that very much sees itself as fighting for the very existence of civilization. It demonizes Palestinians, it demonizes those who are trying to challenge its rule, and that kind of ethno-nationalism, and I talk a lot about this in the book, is I think what makes Israel as a state today so dangerous, because the allure of ethno-nationalism for many, ethno-nationalism, just for listeners if they're wondering what I mean by that, is a state, I guess, which prioritizes one racial group over another. And Israel, of course, prioritizes Jews. It's a proudly Jewish state. If you're not Jewish, you're discriminated against. The allure of ethno-nationalism is today, in the 2020s, that a lot of nations around the world, India, Hungary being two big examples, deeply admire Israel for that reason. Yes, they also want Israeli technology and weapons, but actually I think it's much more than that. It's a admiration for an ethno-nationalist ideology. India, under Prime Minister Modi, is building a Hindu fundamentalist regime, a deeply dangerous regime which is discriminatory against Muslims. They're often leading government ministers who openly call for genocide against Muslims. And yet, despite that, much of the West is deeply in love with India because they're not China. China is deemed as the great enemy of our times. Apparently, India is not, and therefore will overlook those problems in India. And I think that's highly concerning and frankly stupid, because a nation like India under Modi is not just inspired by Israel, but very much views itself aligned ideologically with states that prioritize one racial group over another. So I'm not saying that what India is doing is solely because of Israel, but Indian officials have openly said that they deeply admire what Israel is doing in the West Bank, bringing in many Jews to settle Palestinian land. And what India is doing now itself in Kashmir is bringing in huge numbers of Hindus to Muslim areas to try to dilute those territories, inspired by the Israeli occupation of Palestine. And just finally on this point, you know, it's not accidental in terms of the admiration of Israeli ethno-nationalism that the global far right deeply admires Israel. I mean, this is crazy situation in the 2020s where for decades and decades the far right traditionally hated Jews. They're anti-Semitic, they're neo-Nazis, and yet they deeply admire Israel, and often you go to their rallies and they're waving the Israeli flag. So that sort of speaks to the dark reality of how Israel's viewed around the world.
Indeed. I'm speaking with Antony Lowenstein about his book, The Palestine Laboratory, How Israel Exports the Technology of Occupation Around the World. That's published by Verso. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So a few minutes ago, you were talking about the affinity in some ways between Israel and the South African apartheid state. And yet that's just one of the many unsavory regimes, brutal regimes that Israel has had as clients of Israeli weapons and technology. Can you tell us about some of the other ones? Let's go back to the mid to late 20th century. Tell us about some of the regimes that Israel did not have any problem selling weapons to during that time when the rest of the world, or at least some parts of the world, was looking away in disgust.
You know, one country that some people might find surprising is Iran. Now, Israel and Iran today are apparently enemies, but in fact, for a long time, Israel was very friendly with Iran. I'm talking about Iran before 1979 and the Islamic Revolution. So under the Shah, a brutal dictator.
Right, and a US-backed state as well.
US-backed state. Israel was a key ally of Iran. They funded them, they armed them, they helped train their secret police. And the reason this is important is that declassified documents have come out, and I put some of these in the book, which really show how this was kind of a very strange relationship, that Israel itself was kind of hoping for some kind of public acknowledgement in a weird way. A prominent global Muslim nation acknowledging Israel as a Jewish state. Almost Israel felt that they needed legitimacy by the Shah to have that publicly, which never actually came. And what's so bizarre is the historical ties are literally just a few months ago, the Shah's son arrived in Israel, apparently bringing a message of peace to the people of Israel and a Jewish state. And what was so bizarre about this was, apart from the fact that so much of the media treated this as somehow a serious visit, the Shah has literally zero support within Iran itself. Zero. He lives in the US. His father was a brutal dictator. It'd kind of be like, I'm trying to think of the equivalent, it'd be like if Saddam Hussein's sons were still alive and they visited, I don't know, a neighboring state and said, oh yes, I'm going to lead my country, Iraq, back to liberation after 2 decades of US-led war. It's such delusional nonsense. And yet in Israel itself, the Shah's son was treated almost like a prized guest. He was given the red carpet treatment. Now, obviously, Iran 2023 is not Iran 1978, 1979, but the idea that Israel is, and frankly, too many people in the Zionist diaspora look to the Shah's son as some kind of potential friend in Iran, is the Shah's son has no friends in Iran itself, the country that you'd think would be the most important one to have friends in. He has friends in the White House. He has friends in the US State Department. He has friends in Israel, but not in the country that he actually wants to apparently lead. So, and of course, I might add that in that whole conversation, when he was in Israel recently, I saw literally not one mention in the Israeli press about what Israel was doing with the Shah decades ago. Backing, funding, arming, training, the most brutal dictatorship imaginable in that country. There's kind of this, I don't know what you call it, it's a willful amnesia, blindness, ignorance, people don't care, history is forgotten, I don't know, but the people of Iran, many of them, they do remember, even the ones who weren't alive, they know historically what kind of support Israel was giving the Shah back in the day, and they want no part in the 2020s of a so-called new revolutionary government led by the Shah's son, who, as far as I'm aware, has never really apologized or acknowledged the kind of dictatorship that his father was running there. So Iran, in some ways, is one of the more curious relationships that Israel had before 1979.
Well, another one that stands out is Israel's support for Pinochet's Chile in the 1970s. Can you talk about that series of relationships with dictatorial regimes in Latin America?
So on 9/11, 1973, obviously the Pinochet regime was instituted a coup in Chile, as you say, and the US very clearly backed that under when Kissinger and Nixon were in the White House. Israel was also a key ally. And this really was the beginning of a very long relationship with a number of Latin and South American dictatorships, many of whom looked to Israel, as I was saying before, for advice on so-called counterinsurgency. And in the coming really decade and a half, numerous countries in that region, many of which were dictatorships, Honduras, Guatemala, Chile, Colombia, they were often both covertly and publicly calling for Israeli support. You had Israeli military figures, you had former Israeli military figures working for private companies, going to these nations, training, literally training death squads, arming, training, advising them how to fight their own enemies, whoever that may be in those countries. And this, I think, is really where the so-called Palestine Laboratory really accelerated, because at that stage, the occupation of the West Bank, Gaza, and East Jerusalem had only begun a few years before in 1967, but already there was a really clear, and I mean, I found some stories, pretty remarkable stories in the New York Times back in the day that were almost promoting this, that were saying that you have all these dictatorial regimes in Latin and South America who are begging for Israeli support. Now, on the face of it, people might say, isn't this bizarre? A country on the other side of the world is being asked for advice in how to carry out its own brutal counterinsurgency against what were normally leftist civilians and activists trying to restore democracy. And Israel was on, as it usually is, on the wrong side of that. The US was usually on the wrong side of that. And I think during those years, Israel was both supporting those regimes because they could make money from, but also because they were hoping to get diplomatic support in the UN and elsewhere. You know, I have this in the book that even from the beginning of the occupation in 1967, a number of Israeli officials kind of realized that a lot of people didn't like it around the world. The occupation wasn't hugely popular, that there were a lot of people who opposed this brutal military occupation. And the way that you insulated yourself to some extent from the possibility of a diplomatic tsunami, then or now, I would say, is you sell weapons to pretty much everybody. So therefore, the perception is everybody needs you. And although if you look at the UN votes pretty much every year, the vast bulk of the world's on one side, the other opposing what Israel's doing, the other side is usually Israel, US, Australia, Micronesia, Palau, Marshall Islands, mostly client states of the US and Israel, and sadly including my own country, Australia. And yet despite that, for decades, Israel enjoys pretty much complete impunity. I would argue, as I do in the book, that I think this does have something to do with the way in which Israeli repressive technology is so vitally important for so many nations. Now, there are examples of nations that have bought Israeli technology that, which have been critical of Israel and the UN. That definitely happens. But it certainly neuters some of that opposition. And in the digital age now, when we've moved from more analog weapons to digital technology, spyware and other sort of tools, Israeli repressive tech has become even more important again, especially in the wake of 9/11.
And I'd like to ask you much more about that, but I wonder if you could, since you've been sort of tracing some of this historically, if you could talk about how Israel's invasion and occupation of Lebanon in the early 1980s was a stepping stone in this process of promoting Israeli weapons around the world.
So Israel's invasion of Lebanon in 1982, really historically, is viewed as a complete disaster. It was bloody, it was brutal. There were huge massacres of Lebanese civilians. There were war crimes committed. There were mass protests within Israel itself against the war. There were huge protests globally against Israel's completely appalling invasion and occupation. It's where Sabra and Shatila, the two massacres that were carried out by Israeli allies, were done and the killing of huge numbers of civilians. And yet, Israel sold this invasion and occupation as a massive success. When I say sold it, they sold it to countries around the world as a model of counterinsurgency. And they were able to sell on the back of that huge numbers of weapons and tools to various nations that looked to what Israel was doing, even though it was complete carnage, essentially. But this, I think, really goes to the heart of it, that the fact that there was complete carnage, the fact that there was no, at least for a long time, really much serious pressure for Israel to end it, what they were doing there. I mean, the occupation didn't end until decades later in 2000. That this in some ways is a model for how many other nations want to commit crimes in their own states. And there were huge numbers of tools and technologies. In fact, Israel was using an early form of drone technology back then, which a lot of countries also were keen to copy. But the Palestine Laboratory then wasn't just actually in tangible weapons, it was also in language. And I go into detail in this in the book that Israel really was fighting back then, and it was already devising the language of its own so-called war on terror. How you talk about an enemy, how you talk about killing people, how you talk about so-called collateral damage, how you demonize any critics as terrorists. And the reason this is so important is that after 9/11, the US adopted so much of this language when they were fighting their own so-called war on terror. Now, I'm not saying everything the US did after 9/11 was simply copied from Israel, but it was a massive factor. This hasn't really been talked about nearly enough as I think it should be. That if you go back and see how Israel was talking about and fighting its war in Lebanon in the 80s, so decades before 9/11, it mirrored very closely what the US was doing after 9/11. And as I said, not just the actual physical actions of, say, what the US was doing, invasion, occupation, black sites, torture, so-called collateral damage, but the language, as I said, of demonizing critics or talking about anybody who opposed your policies as a terrorist. And that was rhetorically very powerful. And I'd say a lot of people in the US copied that playbook after 9/11.
And 9/11, you argue, was a turning point or a significant moment for Israel with the promotion of its military abroad, or the accelerated promotion. At the same time, you also write about how in the early 2000s, while most Israeli military companies were state-owned, that there were changes afoot. So can you describe that moment and its significance for the Israeli state and Israeli weapons companies?
After 9/11, Israel and Israeli officials and Israeli supporters would basically say in any opportunity they could that now the world understands what we've been fighting for decades, namely that we've been fighting a war on terror, we've been fighting Palestinian terrorism, irrational Muslims. This is how the argument went. And now the US gets it. Now the US and its allies get it. And now, because of that, you will more likely follow our way of doing things. And that was largely true. Now, the invasion of Iraq and Afghanistan wasn't because of Israel or inspiration by Israel. Of course it wasn't. The US did that for its own reasons. Well, Afghanistan was obviously under the guise of fighting al-Qaeda, and Iraq was a criminal flight of fancy, to put it mildly. Although Israel, to be clear, did support both of those wars and encouraged both of those wars. So much of the Israeli military-industrial complex hugely accelerated after 9/11 because they were selling themselves around the world as the best allies to have when you're fighting your own war on terror, providing security in places, providing the tools and technologies for the war on terror, providing sophisticated drones, etc., etc. And in some ways that's been incredibly successful for Israel because Israel has built itself up into a hugely profitable military-industrial complex. Israel is now the 10th biggest arms exporter in the world. And I think so much of the catastrophic policy decisions of the US post 9/11, Iraq, Afghanistan, torture, black sites, unaccountable actions. I mean, the list goes on and on and on. And many of those policies, of course, continue today. I mean, the US under Biden is still fighting a so-called war on terror in Syria, in Somalia, drone attacks. They barely get any media anymore. But this, to some extent, really is what Israel has been doing in its own backyard for years. And many of those Israeli companies that have profited from that since 9/11, the spyware companies are some of the more well-known, as we discussed before, NSO Group and others. They were born really in the shadow of 9/11. And what I mean by that is they had nothing to do with that event, or they weren't American. But they were selling themselves as key tools in a nation fighting its own war on terror. And that really what meant in a practical sense, when you're selling spyware to countries, whoever you're selling it to, you're basically selling it so those countries can repress their own populations, go after the journalists, the dissidents, the human rights activists, whoever it may be. And so the US, Israel really saw 9/11, to put it crudely, as a wonderful opportunity. I mean, you often have officials saying that. It's not really me presuming that. I mean, they're often saying that. So, and that hasn't changed much in 20 plus years, despite the US war on terror being a catastrophic disaster. It really, I think, has led to a lot of financial opportunities for not just Israeli companies, but frankly, American companies. I mean, people often say, oh, the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan were a disaster, which they clearly were for the peoples of those countries. But I often say in response, but disasters for whom? The American defense industries did remarkably well in the last 20 years. Private mercenary companies did remarkably well in the last 20 years. And the same in Israel. The same in Israel. So, having written a lot in the last decade about disaster capitalism, I see real kind of synergy between accelerating an endless war and the benefit of those kinds of conflicts for private companies that often do remarkably well. And in fact, just briefly, when the US pulled out of Afghanistan in August 2021, the Taliban, of course, took over again, many American defense companies were really concerned about where they were going to make their next profits. And the war in Ukraine has been an incredible profit booster for them. Now, I'm not suggesting the war in Ukraine has been either started or continued solely because of that. I don't think that at all. But I do think that it's become, I mean, the New York Times, as an example, is running stories regularly about how Ukraine has become a testing ground for new weapons, for new technologies, for new ways of killing. So again, like the US did in Iraq and Afghanistan, where both those countries were testing grounds for weapons, and often those weapons came back home. That's happening in Ukraine, and it's happening in Palestine all the time as well. And just finally, what that means is the occupation always comes home. And what I mean when I say that is that these tools and technologies always end up being used on local populations. So you have in the US police departments that have massively purchased huge amounts of American military hardware that then appears on American streets. Now, obviously, American police forces have their own history of racism. They don't need external help to be racist. And they have in the last 20 years, by the way. A lot of American police have gone to Israel for training, so-called training in counterterrorism and how to manage a population. So again, American police don't need Israel to be racist. But I think it's interesting how a lot of American police openly go to Israel and say, this is kind of how we should be behaving in our own countries. And that, I think, speaks volumes about how effective the Palestine Laboratory has become.
Well, Anthony, you were just talking about the United States and Israel, and I wanted to ask you a bit more about their relationship, because both of them in their own ways have been sort of brand leaders in counterinsurgency. Both have deep histories in training and arming countries to repress their own domestic populations. And obviously, The United States has been a key funder of the State of Israel, as well as having sold the Israeli state, you know, many millions of dollars of weapons. How do you see the relationship between the two? On the one hand, as allied states, is there some level in which they are competitors, or do they have a division of labor? Is this kind of about sharing their acquired wisdom with each other? How would you understand that?
I think it's like an abusive relationship. That's how I very much describe it. On the face of it, they're very close. Israel is one of America's closest allies in the world, as you say. In the last decades, especially since 1967, America has been giving annual aid to Israel of an astronomical amount. I mean, billions and billions and billions of dollars. So they're close allies, no doubt. The US has protected Israel in the past and today in various diplomatic forums. There's never really been any serious pressure internationally at the UN and or elsewhere for Israel to be held to account for its crimes, its occupation, its wars. So on that level, America is a vital ally. But on the other hand, there is, and this started long before Biden, it's been going on for a long time, there's also a lot of weird mistrust. They don't really fully trust each other either. And how that manifests itself practically is they hugely spy on each other. So I have a figure in the book, which is the most accurate that I could find, of every day the NSA, which is obviously America's key intelligence apparatus, has roughly 400 intelligence officers whose primary job is to spy on Israel, nominally one of their closest allies. And you can be assured that that works the same the other way around. Now, I haven't got an exact number of how many Israelis are spying on Americans, but, you know, it'd be quite a lot.
And that's part of a conversation that I recorded with Anthony Lowenstein about the Palestine Laboratory, how Israel exports the technology of occupation around the world. I also spoke several months ago with Sari Makdisi, author of Tolerance is a Wasteland, Palestine and the Culture of Denial. Here's an excerpt from that conversation. So a few minutes ago, you mentioned this phrase that Israel is a Jewish and democratic state, frequently brought up in defense of Israel, and yet, of course, it's a contradictory term because, of course, a state for one group is by definition exclusionary. What has been the power of this term for those beyond the borders of Israel?
Well, the power of the term, it's quite remarkable. It's something that, like in the U.S. in particular, it gets affirmed by politicians pretty much across the spectrum, right? To sort of, we believe in the value of a Jewish and democratic state. And it gets repeated again and again and again, like almost like a magic spell. Like if you just keep saying it, something magical is going to happen by the sheer fact of repeating that particular phrase. And as you point out, Sasha, if you pause and think, but hang on, how can a state be simultaneously exclusive, it's a Jewish state, and inclusive, it's a democratic state? It can't, obviously, the answer is it can't be. It's either, a state can either be inclusive or it can be exclusive. It can't be both simultaneously. So there's an obvious oxymoron at the very in the slogan itself. But nobody pauses to think about the oxymoron. They just reaffirm the value of the wonderful value or the supposedly wonderful value of a Jewish and democratic state. And what that affirmation does is it makes all of the contradictions and oxymorons and so forth disappear. And well, what are those contradictions? How does this state function for its citizens who are not Jewish, for example, which is about 20% of the population of the state within its pre-67 borders, and of course half or more than half of the population of the state of the territory over which the state exerts power, meaning when you include the West Bank, East Jerusalem, the Gaza Strip, and so on, they're roughly equal populations of Jews and non-Jews there. And what happens is, well, I mean, obviously it's apartheid. The historical affirmation of the value of a Jewish and democratic state as a kind of liberal principle, it held sway all through the 1980s and 90s and on, you know, on pretty much to our own time, except that in the past several, really like the past 3 or 4 or 5 years maybe, and in particular, since this most recent Israeli government took office, it's been very, very clear that this state is not interested in democracy, and the literally government ministers and so forth are themselves saying, we're not interested in democracy, we're interested in these other kinds of values. But in a nutshell, the affirmation of a Jewish and democratic state covers up the flip side of that, of the other side of that same coin, which is, of course, an apartheid state. And we could talk about the details of how Israeli apartheid functions inside the pre-67 borders and outside those borders, and it kind of crosses the borders. And there's been several recent studies about Israeli apartheid, so this is hardly an original claim any longer. But yeah, that's part of what's going on.
Well, why don't you say a little more about that and how what functions on the ground in Israel and the occupied territories aligns with a definition of apartheid?
The basic premise of apartheid, and it's not, again, it's not a term that we should just use wantonly or as a kind of emotional accusation. The term is defined precisely in the Apartheid Convention, which has, you know, the status of international law. So you can look up what the definition of apartheid is, and it basically is a system of government that discriminates according to various kinds of criteria, including religion and national origin, and there's a whole, you can go look at the details of the text if you're interested in the details. But basically what it means is a systematically discriminatory state. Now, if you look at what's been happening since 1967 in the territories that Israel captured in the 1967 war, meaning East Jerusalem, the West Bank, and Gaza, it's very, very clear that there's a very rigid distinction between the Jewish and non-Jewish populations of those territories. For example, the Jewish settlers in, let's say, in the West Bank or in East Jerusalem are subject to Israeli civil law. They're guaranteed the protections of Israeli civil law, whereas Palestinian residents in exactly the same territory are subject to Israeli military law. So there's like literally two different systems of law for two different populations inhabiting the same territory. There's different housing, there's different road systems, different schooling systems. I mean, 100% segregation between the Jewish and non-Jewish population of the occupied territories. It's in the occupied territories, this is like, it's a total no-brainer. It's very, very obvious what's happening. President Carter said it in his book in 2006, I think it was, to outrage. But it's very obvious. When you cross the border into pre-67 Israel, things are more subtle. There still is essentially total exclusion and total separation of the two populations, but it's done much more subtly than, let's say, the apartheid state in South Africa did it. So, for example, in South African apartheid, there would be laws saying specifically, you know, blacks have to live in this area and whites have to live in this area, and it was spelled out very explicitly. Inside pre-67 Israel, there aren't exactly any such official or legal pronunciations, but what there are instead are a series of a combination of formal and informal mechanisms that make sure that Jews and non-Jews by and large can't live in the same space. There are some exceptions, that they're very small in the so-called mixed cities, but even then there's extreme forms of segregation. So there really, by and large, there's total separation. So for example, most of the land of the state is state-owned land. And if you're somebody who's not Jewish and you want to rent or lease, or you can't buy, but rent or lease land that's owned by the state, you are not able to do so because you're not Jewish. Whereas somebody who is Jewish, who's not a citizen of the state, for example, even obviously if they are citizens, this also works, but even for non-citizens, they have access to land because it's held in the name of the Jewish people by, for example, the Jewish National Fund, for instance, among other institutions. They have access to this land even though they're not citizens of the state. So here you have a state in which people who are not citizens have more access to land resources than people who are citizens, strictly on the basis of national identity or religion or however you want to define the distinction there. But the point is, there's a structural form of discrimination. And we can go up and down through the whole system. So when a new citizen is born, for example, in the Israeli state, they are entered into the population registry. And somebody who is Jewish is entered as what the state calls a Jewish national. And somebody who's not Jewish is entered as there's a whole bunch of other nationalities, but the point is they're not Jewish. And that's really what matters, because in Israeli law, there's a distinction between nationality, which is something that only Jews can have, and citizenship, which is something that's more open. But the various rights that the state accords tend to go on nationality rather than mere citizenship as such. And so, for example, there's, as I said, housing is largely segregated. The educational systems are largely segregated. There are two different educational systems for Jewish and non-Jewish citizens of the state. I'm talking about the state within its 67 borders. As I said, in the West Bank, it's more obvious, but inside the state too, there's totally discriminatory educational systems that separate and treat and invest in the education of Jewish versus non-Jewish citizens in totally different ways. The state invests, for example, 3 or 4 times as much in educating a Jewish citizen as it does a non-Jewish citizen, and so on and so on and so on. According to Israeli law, if you're Jewish and you want to marry somebody who's non-Jewish, you can't do it in the state. It can't be done. There's no institution of civil marriage. So that these forms of discrimination and separation and segregation are reinforced across the generations. But all we hear our politicians in the West talking about are the wonders of a Jewish and democratic state. Where is this Jewish and democratic state? There's a Jewish state. As a Palestinian politician once pointed out, the state is, it's democratic if you're Jewish, and it's a Jewish state if you're Palestinian. You don't have access to the democratic functioning of the state there. And again, to add to what's been going on in the past 2 or 3 years, there's a number of major reports on Israeli apartheid, published, for example, by the United Nations. There's a branch of the United Nations called ESQA, the Economic and Social Commission for Southwest Asia. They published a major report a few years ago. And then both Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch have also published major, you know, couple hundred page reports that detail the system of apartheid inside pre-67 Israel and in the occupied territories. And all these reports also make a really super important point too, which is that essential to the functioning of Israeli apartheid is the separation of the Palestinian people into these different groups. For example, the biggest single group of Palestinians are the ones who were forced into exile in 1948. They've never been allowed the right to return to their homes in Palestine.
Well, let's loop back to what you referenced a bit earlier, which is the attempt by the State of Israel to present itself to the world, and especially to liberal and progressive supporters, as an icon of gay rights in contrast to the purportedly homophobic rest of the Arab world. Can you tell us more about how Israel tried to achieve that status as a paragon of gay rights and how successful they were in wooing liberal and progressive support?
Well, let's start with the latter question. The good news is it wasn't successful at all. I think it was a dismal failure. And what's interesting about it is this was a, you know, in contrast with, let's say, the planting of forests over the ruins of Palestinian villages, or the mantra of the Jewish and democratic state, which have a much longer kind of heritage. This project to proclaim Israel as a gay paradise, basically, with, you know, like this the, you know, a paragon of gay rights and so forth. And by the way, I should point out, strictly by gay, I mean gay men specifically. I mean, the lesbian rights are much more kind of occluded, for various reasons that we can get into, but it's principally it's been marketed as a, you know, for example, a vacation destination for gay men specifically. And the connection, just to anticipate, that has to do with the army and with the marketing of the army also as allegedly a paradise for gay men. So the project was systematically thought through, and it involved American marketing firms who volunteered their services, American and British marketing firms like Saatchi & Saatchi, for example, among others, who volunteered their services to help kind of promote Israel as primarily a kind of gay vacation paradise, for one thing. And so there were this kind of, you start seeing in the mid to late 2000s, poll after poll after poll talking about the best gay cities in the world, right? And so you would get Berlin but you know that what you'd find out is that, for example, Tel Aviv starts topping all of these charts all of a sudden. San Francisco seems to drop off the radar, which is remarkable. And what you get is Tel Aviv seems to suddenly be the most amazing gay city in the universe. Now, are there gay beaches in Tel Aviv? Yes. Is there a certain degree of freedom for gay people in Tel Aviv? Yes, it's true. As soon as you go much beyond Tel Aviv, the story is entirely different. But that's not whether or not there are gay rights is not the point. The point is, how is this proclamation of gay rights in Tel Aviv used for a much more cynical kind of political project? And as I said, that was done from the beginning, partly to claim that there are no Palestinian gay or queer people, and partly also, of course, to claim that Palestinians are homophobic, that Arabs in general are homophobic, and so therefore we get this contrast between this shiny, wonderful, homophilic Israel as opposed to the barren, terrible, despotic, orientalist, Muslim, Arab homophobia, right? And so that contrast becomes central to this whole project. Now, the reason why it failed is that very, very quickly, you know, along with attempts to market Tel Aviv as this wonderful gay paradise, we get a response by international gay and queer groups, and then very, very vocally as well, Palestinian queer and gay groups as well, who push back against this notion. And you know, for example, when there's attempts, for example, to include Israeli and, you know, Israeli participation in, let's say, gay pride festivals in certain parts of the world, there are immediate responses by local gay, like, for example, Toronto, to name one case. Local gay or queer groups resist the inclusion of an Israeli, you know, participation in let's say, a gay pride parade, for example, on the basis that this is also, it's not just, you know, whether or not there are gay rights is immaterial when we're talking about an apartheid state, because we have to take into account the larger political context as well, and the ways in which, or the extent to which, gay rights are being used in this particular instance here it is again, like the larger argument of the book, right? The affirmation of gay rights is the flip side of the coin, the other side of which is the denial of Palestine and the kind of really the affirmation of apartheid, in effect, right? So it's a coin that has these two sides. The shiny side is the one that people are shown. The more obscure side is the one that's engaged with a process of denial.
That was part of a conversation with Sari Makdisi, professor of English and comparative literature at UCLA, recorded earlier this year. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening, and please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.